state's high court shuts down hopes for a wider cannabis market in Florida. Good Tuesday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a nice, happy, and restful Memorial Day weekend. As we get back to business here on the show this week, just ahead, we've got an update on all things cannabis here in Florida and beyond. Join us. The number to call in, 549-2937. Then later, plans to activate the St. John's Riverfront are moving right along as a new month begins. We'll tell you how you can be part of that conversation. First, though, here's your COVID update for the first day of June. Some good news to start off the month. New positive cases have been trending downward in the state. That said, the death toll keeps growing every day. There are now 36,773 deaths now reported in Florida from the virus. How to end this? More shots going into more arms will drive those deaths and hospitalizations down. So please go get your vaccine, people. Well, our top story this morning, it's a major ruling for the state's emerging cannabis industry. The Florida Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to the state's medical marijuana law. Now, in effect, their ruling keeps in place a controversial system around this business known as vertical integration. What does it mean? Well, basically that only a small number of growers can make money in Florida's cannabis business, at least for the time being. Sally Kent Peebles is on the line. She's a partner with Vicente Cederberg and a member of the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Hey, Sally, good to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
And what are your questions, everyone, about growing cannabis in Florida as the Florida Supreme Court ruled to limit the number of players that can get in on this cash crop, because that's what it is. It is a cash crop. 549-2937, as we talk cannabis this Tuesday. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page, as ever, is open. Sally, tell us about this ruling. A company called FloraGrown brought the case, and what were they trying to get the court to rule on?
Yes, so FloraGrown is a group out of Tampa, and they sued the Department of Health, challenging two primary aspects of the medical marijuana statute. Number one, the cap on the number of licenses is at the state level, and then they were challenging the required vertical integration. The case, FloraGrown won in the lower court, and the Department of Health kept appealing it all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court. We've been waiting on that ruling for quite some time now, and they did rule last Thursday and sided with the Department of Health. So this just means the status quo will continue. You know, FloraGrown was arguing that the system was monopolistic, saying the cap limits the number of companies that can participate, making less medical marijuana available. And the Supreme Court countered that and said, you know, limiting the number of licenses is within the legislator's authority to do so. And that evidence actually supports that there's plenty of medical marijuana on the market. And further, they argued that it's not monopolistic because there is a mechanism within the law that allows more licenses to be issued as the number of patients increases, which is true. You get, for every 100,000 patients that are registered, the Department of Health is supposed to issue 4 new licenses. However, because of FloraGrown, everything's been in limbo, and they haven't issued any licenses in several years now. So now that FloraGrown is behind us, we anticipate that the state will move forward with an application process. It's a little unclear how many licenses they will issue, but I'm guessing anywhere between 12 to 26 new licenses.
Well, how many entities are licensed now in the state to put this product on the market?
In 2015, they issued 5 licenses. And interestingly, that's actually the only licenses that the state issued through an application process.
That is a pretty small club.
It is. Very small club. And you can imagine if you spend a lot of money applying for these licenses, sometimes it's several $100,000. You hire consultants and lobbyists, and these applications can be 1,000 pages, right? So when you spend all that money and you lose in that merit-based process, what are you going to do? Most people are going to sue the state. And that's what we saw here in Florida. Mm-hmm. 17 of the groups that lost in that initial 2015 application process sued the state. So now we have 22 licensees in the state of Florida, and only 5 of those were actually issued through an application process.
549-2937. What are your questions about cannabis as we talk with cannabis attorney Sally Kent Peebles? There's so much money on the table that you can understand, Sally, why these businesses would sue. I mean, if you want to open a burger franchise or a, you know, an ice cream franchise, you don't need to go through these hurdles. The state is keeping such a tight lid on this product. Where does this legal fight go from here?
Well, Supreme Court decisions in Florida are final and they're binding on matters of state law. So a lot of people have been asking me, well, can they go up to the Supreme Court of the United States? Well, because it's federally illegal, marijuana is federally illegal, it can't be a federal question. Mm-hmm. So it will end at this decision. And from here, the state will move forward with the current statute and most likely issue licenses through another competitive application process. So, you know, what your listeners should understand is if Florgren had won, the state would have had to go back to the drawing board and write another statute, which would have allowed for businesses, for mom and pop. And it would have dismantled that vertical integration, which simply means one business owns and controls every stage of the supply chain. We see this outside of cannabis. Think of Apple. You know, the company Apple, they manufacture their own screens and the iPhones, and they own their own manufacturing facilities, and they even own the local, the retail locations where the Apple iPhone and all their products are sold. Same thing with vertical integration in cannabis. We, you know, where people say seed to sale. You have one company being required in Florida to grow it, process it, distribute it, transport it, and sell it. And that makes this very expensive. Can you imagine having to be in control of the whole process? Mm-hmm. So you're looking at a higher cost of entry for licensees because only a few people in the world can really spend that much money to open these businesses. So it cuts out the ability for mom and pops to enter in Colorado and Oregon that doesn't have vertical integration and they have horizontal integration or allowed for people to have horizontal vertigration, someone can just open a cultivation or just open a dispensary. You know, it's less expensive to enter the program.
A low barrier to entry. Well, you mentioned that the Florida Supreme Court's decision is final. That said, recently, Democrats in the House of Representatives reintroduced the MORE Act, the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act. It would remove cannabis from the Federal Controlled Substances Act. It would wipe out marijuana-related offenses from some Americans' criminal records. It would do a lot of things around cannabis. This is one of the few issues where you see bipartisan support for reform. Both Democrats and Republicans and independents favor marijuana legalization. So it's interesting to watch this dynamic unfold as you see legalization bubbling up in the states, whether it's for marijuana or full recreational use. The big sticking point, of course, is what will the federal government do? Will they take the lead from the states at some point and just simply decriminalize this substance? What do you think about that possibility?
Well, I think you're right on. You know, 2/3 of Americans support legalization, and this includes a majority in every age group, every education level, every income level. You know, this is no longer a stoner issue. Mm-hmm. It's also notable that 48% of Republicans, and while 83% of Democrats do support it, but you have 48% of Republicans coming out for legalization. However, at the federal level, these acts need to win. They need to be voted on by a super majority. So you're going to need 60% support to get these things passed. And you're just not going to see that happen. Most likely not under not under this administration. We still have to sway about 10 Republicans, and I'm not sure that will happen. Mm-hmm. However, it's still important to get these issues voted on. Because it really puts the members of Congress on record so the American people know who supports cannabis and doesn't, and also says on which individuals do we need to spend money to lobby and educate. And this whole issue really comes down to education. You know, I think if people understood the issues and understood that legalization makes our community safer and that it's healthier and that it addresses social issues. I think if education was made paramount, that this would become a non-issue, and we would see passage at the federal level.
Give us a call as we talk cannabis with attorney Sally Kent Peebles. She's also on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee, 549-2937. Richard in Riverside. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a comment that the current system really is cost prohibitive to people with lower incomes because of the cost of the product. And so earlier on, you mentioned the fact that there were a limited number of growers or suppliers. And because there's not more competition, the price is just expensive for a majority of the people that might need it.
That's so true, Richard, and thanks for that. You know, Sally, this sort of runs afoul of what Republicans typically will say about the free enterprise system. They are really highly regulating and controlling a profitable product that does provide relief to people with a lot of medical issues. And if there were more choice and competition, it would make the product more affordable to more patients.
Absolutely. And that really goes, again, to the required vertical integration aspect of this. The lack of competition, as you mentioned, can lead to lower quality products because you're not, held up to a higher standard. Not always, but that's an argument. And you'll have less product variety. And all of these things are going to end up being higher cost to patients at the end of the day. So the product is going to be more expensive. But there are pros to vertical integration.
And what are those?
At least you're talking about with the Republicans and their arguments. I mean, their arguments are, there's potential lower cost with regulatory oversight. They see a consistency in products. If there's an issue, they can immediately have one company pull that product from the shelf quicker. They see improved coordination in supply chain. I'm not here to give an opinion, but there are pros and cons to both. I have operated in both. I lived in Colorado for several years where we have permissive vertical integration but not required. And I felt that that was a better system with more companies and a much more robust economy was created by the marijuana program there. But, the program we have here under required vertical integration is working. Patients are getting medicine. And now that FluoroGrown has made their decision, there is certainty for investors. A lot of these licensees that have recently been licensed by the state have really not been expanding. They've chosen to kind of hold back until FluoroGrown was decided because it kind of left them in no man's land. Like, what is my license going to be worth? Can I raise capital to expand? Well, now they have a decision. They can get capital infused, and then they can push forward with expansion, and expansion does mean more patient access.
Matt in St. Augustine. Hi, Matt. Happy Tuesday. Hope you had a good holiday. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Instead of the state regulating the number of licensees to a small number, I'd rather see them put an effort into checkups on the growers, checkups on the doctors that are writing the prescriptions to follow up on a lot of bogus prescriptions, invalid ones, and things like that, instead of focusing so much on limiting the growers, the number of growers.
Okay, thanks for that, Matt. Sally, what about Matt's comment?
I don't see eye to eye with that comment necessarily. He referred to the growers as bogus. I mean, this is a very highly restricted program where this product is tested. They have heavy inspections. So I'm not, I'd love more color on that. My husband's actually the lead cultivator for one of these, one of the MMTCs in Florida. And I know he works really hard to provide the best product for the patients. And, he's a cannabis cancer survivor himself. So there is a lot of effort to provide the best medicine to the patients in Florida as possible. And for the bogus prescriptions, I think doctors are doing the best they can. There is a wide range of debilitating medical conditions that qualify a patient to have access to medical marijuana. In my opinion, there should be more debilitating medical conditions listed. I think anyone who feels that they should be able to use medical marijuana as a healthier, safer alternative to prescriptions and opioids and any other, you know, prescription drugs, I think that they should have that ability to try medical marijuana and see if that is a better or safer alternative for themselves.
And with that, let me ask you your thoughts about the proposed legislation that went down to defeat in Tallahassee this spring on THC caps of this product, the amount of cannabis in the product. There was an effort to reduce the amount of medicine in the product. That failed. But anyway, the reason people want this product is because it has THC that relieves their pain or their nausea from chemo or whatever the reason is that they're taking it. So do you expect this to resurface, this effort to sort of water down the product?
Yeah, I really hope it doesn't. But unfortunately, we're seeing this, you know, my firm is a national cannabis firm. So we had to combat this issue with, interest groups trying to limit the THC in the product in several different states this legislative session. And they tried it in Colorado as well. And thankfully, it did not pass in Florida. I think all of these efforts are really based in lack of education and fear towards, you know, outdated attitudes towards marijuana. And I think if we educate the public on this and educate the legislators, you know, even the legislator who put forward the THC cap bill, he has since said, hey, come to me, provide some, you know, valid research that high THC does not damage, you know, patients, and I'll consider it. And so we're working on getting that information to him. I think even he recognizes it's his own lack of education or his understanding of this plant that creates these knee-jerk reactions to try to cap the THC in these products, which really is, you know, is not very helpful. All that does is take the patients that are able to get it from a regulated, tested market and pushes them back into the black market, because it's not like they're going to stop buying it. They're just going to try to get it from the black market. And the whole purpose of regulating this is try to, you know, to eradicate the black market and push them into the regulated market where product is tested.
549-2937, as we are talking cannabis news on the show today with cannabis attorney Sally Kent Peebles. Kat in Mandarin. Hello, Kat.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to bring to light some news. Recently bought Harvest House of Cannabis. And when that news came out, my friends and I were a little bummed just because of the service and the pricing. You know, it seems like these bigger companies are buying out the smaller ones. And the person just said, you know, the black market is competitive and it's really expensive to buy from the dispensaries as is right now. It's a concern.
Thank you for that. Okay, so that gets back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, Sally, that the ruling from the Florida Supreme Court creates, according to critics anyway, a monopolistic system for this market.
Well, you know, when it comes to specifically Trulieve, you know, they are certainly the leader size-wise in Florida. I think they have something like 70% of the market share in Florida. They did purchase Harvest, which is another licensee in Florida. They are actually a national multi-state operator, so they're not a small company at all. Harvest is a pretty massive company in its own right. I don't know what that's going to mean for the patients in Florida, you know, if it's going to raise or lower prices, but I think that, you know, it may actually lower their prices because they're able to, you know, have bigger facilities and maybe that will help. I can't weigh in on what the result of that would be, but we're certainly, just as any industry matures, you're going to start seeing consolidation.
Let me ask you as well, some other cannabis news and notes we're following. A lot of cities have decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana. That's been introduced locally at the Jacksonville City Council. The votes aren't there, at least not at this point, to pass the council. What about these efforts in other Florida cities and at the statewide level to decriminalize possession of small amounts of this drug? Organizers behind reform of marijuana laws say that would actually make communities safer and it would free police up to focus on other matters. What about this?
I fully support decriminalization. And, you know, there is a distinction between decriminalization and versus legalization. You know, decriminalization is when legal consequences for, you know, possession of small amounts of marijuana are not severe. When someone's caught with the small amounts, they won't face prosecution or jail time. They could get charged with a civil offense or a minor misdemeanor. They may have to pay a fine. It's often compared to like a parking ticket. Legalization, on the other hand, is when adults can actually legally use and possess them, and where marijuana will be regulated and generally put in a storefront for people to purchase. So the efforts that we see in the state of Florida by some local municipalities to decriminalize is, in my opinion, kind of a step towards legalization. I think it certainly addresses the social justice issues that we talk about surrounding legalization. You don't want people to face criminal consequences for using a small amount of personal marijuana. Or at least, you know, most Americans feel that is the case. And I think decriminalization does address that. And it did not pass in Jacksonville, but I believe they will be presenting it again.
And before we go to another caller, tell us a little bit about your group. It's called Wise Florida, that is working on these issues of access and also the effort to legalize the product for recreational use in Florida.
Absolutely. So, you know, what a lot of people don't know is that women played a very significant role in ending alcohol prohibition. You know, 90 years ago, it was the end of alcohol prohibition experiment, and the U.S. was kind of dealing with the similar issues that we're seeing now with marijuana, with different states legalizing it. And that was going on with alcohol back then. And it was women that really joined together to end alcohol prohibition. I mean, one of the groups, the Women's Organization on National Prohibition Reform, had over 1 million members. So I started with some other mothers and women in the state of Florida. We started the Women's Initiative for a Safe and Equitable Florida. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to building support for sensible cannabis policy through education. And just like the women who fought to end alcohol prohibition a century ago, we recognize the harm that cannabis prohibition is causing, and we're going to take action and concern for the well-being of our families and communities.
One more call on this. It's John on the South Side. Hi, John. How are you? Go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. My question is, did the Supreme Court rule on the medical cannabis businesses? Did they rule that the mom and pops with maybe 20 or 30 acres could not invest into this business and grow and profit off of the legalization of medical marijuana?
Essentially, yes. John, thanks for that. Sally?
Yes, that is what they ruled. You know, basically, they're saying that they are not going to issue any licenses to grow or sell or process marijuana in the state of Florida unless you apply through a merit-based application process. And so you would be permitted to go through that process. That process has not been announced yet by the state of Florida, but we anticipate it being announced soon. It will be competitive. So very expensive to apply, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. Mm. And we really don't know what those parameters are yet, but hopefully we will soon.
And do you expect full legalization to get on a Florida ballot in the next few years?
So to get, you know, the Supreme Court of Florida also ruled that the Make It Legal Florida campaign language could not be placed on the ballot next year. And so they have to start from scratch with new language. And that also means they have to start from scratch with new signatures. I believe they would have to get around almost close to 900,000 signatures by next February to get something on the ballot. It's very expensive to get signatures. It's, again, not out of the realm of possibility. And there are a lot of discussions going on to get something on the ballot. It's definitely needed in Florida. You know, the state of New York just legalized last month, and that's huge news. If New York did it, I certainly, and California's done it, I certainly think Florida should join those ranks. But But right now there's nothing planned. And I hope that Wise Florida, the group I started, can help coordinate with some other interested parties in the state of Florida to get something on the ballot.
We'll continue to follow it. Always great to get your insights. She's Sally Kent Peebles with the cannabis firm Vicente Cederberg on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee and a founder of the new group Wise Florida on this issue of cannabis reform. So, Sally, thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Much more still ahead. Coming up later in the hour, Duval Sports News and Notes with our own Josh Torres. But up next.
There is so much going on at the library. You know, first and foremost, summer, what we want people to do is read. So we want kids to read 15 minutes a day.
How you and your kids can activate a wealth of summer learning programs that kick off today at the Jacksonville Public Library. We'll be right back. Well, summer learning starts today at the Jacksonville Public Library, and there's so much going on at your local library branch that you can enjoy with your kids. I learned more from spokesman Chris Boven. Hi, Chris. Happy summer. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Melissa. Good to talk to you also.
Okay, so for all the parents out there looking for activities with their kids, now that school is out, you want to remind them about all the fun at the library, summer learning at the library. What do you have planned?
Thanks, Melissa. There is so much going on at the library we have planned. First and foremost, summer, what we want people to do is read. So we want kids to read 15 minutes a day. If they do that for 15 days, they'll get a free book. 15 minutes is a great target, and it's a way that's going to really keep kids on the path to building up those wonderful reading skills that are just invaluable.
That's right. Get them reading, get them checking books out at the library. And with summer learning, you've got some activities going on at the library branches around town, and even a summer theme too, right?
Yes, right. So the theme of summer is Tales and Tales. So it's animal stories, animal adventures, and there's going to be all kinds of great animal themes all summer long. We are really excited to be returning to some in-person programming. So we're going to have story time. We're calling them pop-up story times. They're happening at parks around the city, and so it'll be an outdoor park. You'll be able to participate in the great story times that you love, and we're really excited. Our storytellers and librarians are really excited to be getting out there and mix it up with the kids, dance, sing, jump around, and have a great time. We also have all the great events that you're used to, like magicians and animal handlers and things like that, but these are going to be virtual events. We want people to gather in the library to watch them all together, so we're going to set up big projectors, and we're going to have watch parties in the libraries for people to come and join and gather together and get to see some of these really awesome entertainers.
This is so great, because after a year of being cooped up and kids, many of them in virtual school for a lot of it, it's nice to see with summer this kind of option opening up, and whether you go to your branch library or come to the downtown library, people can access everything through the website, jackspubliclibrary.org. And if you've never been to your neighborhood library branch, there's so much happening there, Chris. People can do research there. They can job search. They can.
Right.
There's a lot to offer.
Yeah, there's so much to do at the local, at your local branch, and we're really happy to be open. All the libraries have inside hours now, so you can come to the library and you can do a lot of stuff. And there's going to be other great things for kids at the libraries, like self-guided things like scavenger hunts and trivia walls. So you'll be able to pick up art kits to take home and bookmarks to track your reading. So we hope everybody gets out and visits your neighborhood library.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a better use of our tax dollars than the public library. You know, it is worth its weight in gold. So this is such an easy, free thing we can all access this summer. What else should people know to learn about what's going on at the library?
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. So, yeah, it is. We love to be able to make the most out of everybody's tax dollars. And so the other thing we want people to know is that we want you to connect with us and get on our email list, and that way you're not going to miss a thing. You will get all the information you want right in your email box. You'll get information about upcoming programs. You'll get things that you can do at home, reading, watching, learning, exploring. And not only that, but you get more chances to win great prizes. So if you do some of these things that you get in your email, do some of these little challenges, you're going to get a chance to enter in some raffles for a bunch of really cool prize packages. So, yep, just like you said, jackspubliclibrary.org, look for summer learning /summer, and sign up for the email list so you don't miss a thing.
Sign up for it, jackspubliclibrary.org/summer. He's Chris Boven, Assistant Director of Community Relations and Marketing with the Jacksonville Public Library. Get on that mailing list. Get your kids reading and doing fun things at the library. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Well, as a new month begins, conversations across town are continuing about plans to better activate the shoreline of the St. John's River. Let's talk about it right now as we welcome Jimmy Orth, Executive Director at the St. John's Riverkeeper. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
Good to have you. And Claire Wise is with us. She's founding principal of the New York-based architecture, planning, and design firm WXY Studio. Hey, Claire.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good to have you both. Claire, in a moment, we'll talk about what your firm is doing to help the brightest minds in this city work on this problem. But Jimmy, let's begin with you. There's a real concerted effort to activate the riverfront, and that's been going on for a while. How is the St. John's Riverkeeper playing in this space? What are you contributing to the conversation?
Well, we're part of a coalition of numerous groups that have formed around, we're called Riverfront Parks now, and our goal is to create more riverfront parks to provide access to the St. John's, and one of our roles is to make sure that we are looking at this through a resiliency lens so that mm-hmm. we can utilize the riverfront as a way to help buffer and protect our city from flooding, sea level rise, and climate change.
So important. So, Claire, tell us about what your firm is doing here in Jacksonville and how you worked on these issues in other cities, too, because you bring a lot of insight to this role.
Melissa, thank you. And Jimmy, nice to meet you. Well, we've just started a process with DVDL and really funded by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund to kind of help with the holistic view of the waterfront in Jacksonville. You know, there's been a huge amount of plans and efforts and the enthusiasm amongst people about getting to the water is really, and the progress that's being made is palpable, but it's actually a real challenge in all cities. You know, from New York, where we're based, to Washington, D.C., to everywhere, to actually make sure that things are aligning, that one project is not actually kind of diminishing the returns to the waterfront of another project. So I think we're really looking, you know, and as sort of a planning firm and a design firm, there's a real opportunity here to address how people and resiliency work together.
I would think this would be challenging. I mean, the idea is to activate the waterfront. At the same time, we have to plan ahead for floods, storm surges. This is something that your firm has worked on in the Bay Area, New York. You're working, I think, in Captiva, Florida on this. So,
and you know, through bigger cities, the big challenge is always that people want to raise the edge, right? And that blocks views of the water, and in many cases blocks access to the water. So that's always the big challenge. How do people get to and make use of the water when, in fact, one of the main techniques in helping cities adapt is, in fact, raising the edge.
How do you see that happening, Jimmy? Because, you know, when we think about the St. John's River flowing through downtown, its beauty and its incredible potential is something that I think all of us have recognized for so long, and it's so frustrating that we haven't better taken advantage of it. And so what about what Claire said?
Well, yes, it absolutely is a challenge, and I think that's the thing that we recognize that parks can provide, is that if you have waterfront parks, you're going to have to spend money to make your cities more resilient anyway, so why not try to use those parks as a strategy to help with that resiliency effort? So in other words, a lot of parks are being built to use green infrastructure or natural infrastructure to help hold storm waters, to help slow down, absorb the energy from storm surge so it doesn't proceed so far inland, and helps to protect communities from flooding. And so there's lots of ways to do that with natural infrastructure and green parks that can also, the benefit of parks is they provide all of these other co-benefits as well that benefit our economy, benefit our quality of life, from health and wellness to recreational opportunities, opportunity to actually access and experience the St. John's River, but also they're economic drivers. They actually attract businesses, residents, and jobs to downtowns because people want to live and work and play at and around parks.
Yeah. And what else are you doing at the Riverkeeper to protect the waterway, protect wetlands, the wildlife? This is your mission. Bring us up to date on what you're doing.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's so many challenges. As you know, Melissa, the river's 310 miles long. The watershed of the St. John's is almost 9,000 square miles, which represents about 15% of the land area of the state, which is huge. So there's challenges with growth and development, which we're working on. We're also working on the pollution that goes into the river. For instance, at the headwaters, which obviously the river flows north towards us, we're trying to prevent sewage sludge that's being placed on farms and ranch lands from leaching off and flowing towards us and causing problems like algae blooms. And also, like you mentioned, trying to protect that natural infrastructure, those wetlands and salt marshes, which are so critical. And that's where we can take property sometimes and recreate to a certain extent the natural benefits that those natural systems provide on places like parks. A good example is in New York City, Hunters Point Park. They've actually taken an old industrial area, which you could say is similar to our shipyards. It was a floodplain before it was industrialized. Same with the shipyards. It was a floodplain of the river. And they've gone back and tried to recreate the hydrology. So they've put in wetland systems that can help hold stormwater, help prevent storm surge. So there's ways that we can protect what we have today, which is the natural systems that exist today. But we can also help try to recreate those natural hydrologies and those functions that they provide to us as humans and as communities. And we can do that through our parks.
All right. And Claire, tell us a little bit more about what your firm is doing with design, whether it's parks or other design strategies that you've implemented in New York, in other cities around the country that take into account these resiliency initiatives. What are some examples that you've done that we might see here in Jacksonville?
Great, love to. And what Jimmy is talking about is really exact design. So I love the fact that really from a kind of riverkeeper perspective, I think it's becoming clear that in order to make these raised edges, the restoration of coastal meadows, all work for people even next to downtown areas, for workers and for people moving to downtown, they actually have to be designed to work together. But they can work. I think, you know, we did a lot of work post-Sandy in two parks I wanted to mention. One is the Battery in Lower Manhattan, which is, again, ongoing. But in that case, the park itself, each of the elements were raised slightly to anticipate future storms. Now, they held during Sandy, but you could just see with rising sea levels, next time it wasn't going to work. So there's a further effort now in looking at that park and all the things in it and creating a sort of safer area. And that requires transition. So when the Rockaway Boardwalk, when we got a chance to redesign that, and again, I would say that it's a better design now than it was before. It's also about 9 feet taller than it was but when it got destroyed under Sandy. And so that required designing ramps and steps and landings and those transitions between the blocks that people lived on and the boardwalk and between the boardwalk and the beach. And there's these big colored letters now out of the planks themselves that spell out Rockaway. And there's ramp steps that allow someone to now easily get their surfboard up and down. And many of these things didn't exist before. There was like little rickety wood steps. And if you had a stroller, you were, you know, it was just a pain to get to the beach. So I would say there's this opportunity for design to create places that are even more popular. I just wanted to mention that there about this issue of coastal meadow restoration. You know, we think about in the Northeast, we think about that in a Northeast sense. But the truth is that Florida has fantastic opportunities for coastal meadow restoration, and they're equally as important.
So
and that's sort of what's happening in Captiva that we're doing is a transforming of what was a sort of lawn with one ecosystem into around 20 acres of coastal meadow.
Wow. These sound like these are ambitious ideas that we could see adopted in Jacksonville. Quick question to both of you. Are you hoping to do something bold enough here, be part of a coalition to produce something bold enough here that it could be a model for other cities?
I mean, I would say yes, I hope so. I mean, I think the good thing about Jacksonville is we have a lot of opportunity. You know, there's not many cities that have as much, have the blank slate that we have, for instance, along our downtown riverfront. How many cities actually have that much undeveloped land owned by the taxpayers with which to work with and do what Claire said, design it in a way that it attracts people, provides
and
great recreational opportunities, but also helps protect our city.
And we'll have to leave it there. I'm so sorry to cut you off. We're about to hit a break. Jimmy Orth, St. John's Riverkeeper.
Understand.
Claire Wise, founding principal at the New York firm WXY Studio, as we follow this process. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Bye now. Melissa.
In a moment, our own Josh Torres on Duval Sports News and Notes. Lots happening this summer. We'll be right back.
Nonprofit Center presents Resilient 2021, a virtual summit on June 17th. Equity and well-being are key for a healthy nonprofit workforce. This summit is made possible by Community First Credit Union. Learn more at nonprofitctr.org.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves, host of Travel with Rick Steves. Join me virtually Thursday, June 17th at 7 p.m. as I join WJCT Public Media's president, David McGowan, for an evening of travel conversation. Visit wjct.org/events to register.
It takes millions of truck drivers to make the U.S. economy work, but many of them are older and retiring.
Our industry right now needs an additional 60,000 truck drivers ASAP, and it's a deficit that's expected to grow.
I'm Kimberly Adams. What's next for the trucking industry? Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Sturgill Simpson has had a year to reflect on the death of his friend, the legendary songwriter John Prine, but he's still looking for the words he'd use if he had one more chance to say goodbye.
I don't know, man. Probably just hug him and tell him to love him, and I don't know.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Last year's hurricane season set new records and cost the country more than $40 billion. President Biden says we cannot afford to be caught off guard.
We all know that these storms are coming, and we're going to be prepared. We have to be ready. We have to be ready.
At the start of this year's hurricane season, a guide on what you need to know. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars' Urban Meyer had a little fun this weekend, and that leads off our discussion of Duval Sports news and notes with our own director, Josh Torres. He's got lots to share this morning. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Melissa.
All right. So what was Urban Meyer up to over the weekend?
Yeah. So this weekend, we got to see a little bit of Urban Meyer along with assistant coach Charlie Strong as they both appeared in a little cameo role in AEW's Double or Nothing pay-per-view during a match with Chris Jericho taking on MJF. They just happened to go into the stadium and they just busted into a room that Urban and Charlie were both just sitting in having a meeting. And the two of them, after brushing off the surprise of having two very big wrestlers bust into the room, decided, you know what, let's get involved. And so Charlie Strong threw a couple footballs over to Chris Jericho, and then they topped it off with Urban Meyer handing Jericho his laptop that he proceeded to smash over the head of MJF before they both exited the room, and they, I would say, presumably got back to their meeting and probably put in a request for a new laptop.
Probably so. Okay, at the same time that was going on, the Jaguars are looking at off-season workouts. They've got Tim Tebow signed to a year deal. Trevor Lawrence suited up for the first time in a Jaguars jersey. So set the table for us with the Jags.
Yeah, so obviously the big news, nothing that anybody hasn't heard of yet. The team did sign Tim Tebow to a one-year deal. League minimum contract at $920,000. No guaranteed money. No signing bonus. You know, it's definitely 50-50 when you look at how fans feel about this. Mm-hmm. A lot of them feel it's a little too gimmicky. Why are we giving Tebow another chance? He's had so many chances. And there are others who be like, hey, you know what? Give the guy a chance. Let's see what he can do. And Urban Meyer has said that he's the ultimate competitor. You give him a goal, he will do everything in his power to reach that goal. And the Jags have already kind of gotten what they needed out of him in a sense of right after the signing, his jersey was the top-selling jersey on NFLShop.com. So they're already selling the merchandise. You know, we have a very huge Gator fan base here in Jacksonville. So, hey, you know what? In my opinion, give the guy a chance. Let's see what he can do.
Sure.
You know, they're not tied down for anything. And then we saw Trevor Lawrence for the first time take a couple throws. Urban Meyer said they're not restricting how many throws he takes during workouts. They're just keeping an eye on each throw. If they see anything they don't like, they'll take it and make sure with the medical staff that he's okay. The one thing to remember, he's going to have his good days, as Urban Meyer has said, that he has good days, but then he has bad days. He is a rookie. The NFL game is much different than the college game. We can't expect him, as much as Jaguar fans really do want to come out strong, hey, you know what? He's going to make his mistakes. This is his rookie year. We'll just have to see what happens.
And meanwhile, let's talk about baseball for just a second. The Jumbo Shrimp, let's begin with them. They are sitting at fourth in their division in their first season in AAA, and full capacity game coming up next week.
Yep. So right now they are 14-10, their first season in AAA ball. They're sitting fourth in the division. And then, yeah, and starting next week on June 8th when they take the Norfolk Tides on, they are going to be at full capacity. This is big, but, you know, we're starting to see stuff really open up here, especially in Florida. So you're going to start seeing a full ballpark over at 121 Financial Ballpark.
That's going to be fun. It's always fun to enjoy a little minor league baseball. Speaking of which, let's give a shout out to JU. Their Dolphins baseball won a big title.
Yes, they did. They won the Atlantic Sun Conference baseball title. The team, actually, this was definitely your all-around Cinderella story. They came in at 16-32 for the overall record with a 3-15 conference record. And they had to go through two top-seeded teams before they could even get to the title game. And then they won it, and they found out they're going to be trying to go for the College World Series. They're going to go to the tournament, play in Columbia, South Carolina this Friday against top-seeded Old Dominion. So we're going to have to see if they can continue that Cinderella story.
Wow, let's go Dolphins. And last but not least, let's talk about the Indy 500. Now, I know you're a Formula One guy, Josh.
Yes.
But and we know all about that. But tell us about the Indy 500.
Yeah, it was this past Sunday was the 105th running of the Indy 500. It was also the largest sports event since COVID started. They invited 135,000 fans to IMS. It's the largest crowd since COVID started, and we got to see quite a show as Helio Castroneves won his fourth Indy 500 title. That ties the record. There's only four drivers in the history of the Indy 500 who have won it four times, and he did it in spectacular fashion, passing Alex Palou with three laps to go down the main straight down front of the grandstands. And as he's nicknamed the Spider-Man, because once he won, he immediately climbed the crash barriers and gave the fans a show. So it was a great race, and it was quite something to see 135,000 people cheering on as he went on to win his fourth race.
That's exciting. And it's exciting to have you now giving us some sports headlines once a week. Follow Josh on Twitter at Josh is a polar bear. Is that because you always wear shorts?
No, that was more of a joke that kind of just stuck with me.
Okay. Our own Josh Torres, thanks so much. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director and sports anchor Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. And you, keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or tweet me at Melissa Injax. Catch our podcast up later today, wherever you like to listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great first day of June.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.